Okay. So my topic today is interpretive explanation in international studies, and you'll notice on the slide that I've put the in international studies part in parentheses. And that's both just kind of a typographical reminder for me to explain to you what this grows out of, and also there's a broader sort of conceptual point here. The reminder part is easy. I was invited to a workshop at Berkeley about a month and a half ago. Workshop was about a month and a half ago, which was a workshop on interpretive methods in the English school. And I know nothing about the English school as a conceptual entity. I know people who get identified as or self-identify as part of the English school, but I'm not a person who works on quote unquote the English school, so that obviously wasn't what I was doing there. Instead, I was invited to spend some time thinking about interpretation and interpretive methods. And this is a discussion that I've been engaged in for a very long time with a number of colleagues, folks like Dvorah Yanow, Perry Schwarz-Shay in the United States, Robert Adcock, Fred Schaeffer, Cecilia Lynch, a whole bunch of folks that have been trying to grapple with this question of what it means to have an interpretivist approach to the study of politics. I have never been happy with that language. I have never liked the terms of the debate. And so, what I wanted to use that paper as an occasion to do was to try to think through the question of what interpretivism might mean if we wanted to try to lend it some kind of operational content, like if it actually meant something to do interpretivist work or to be an interpretivist, what could that actually mean? So that was kind of the project that was initially set up. The reason international studies is kind of in parentheses is because this was somehow supposed to relate to something having to do with the English school part of the conference, the workshop topic. During the course of the workshop, we discovered what it is that the actual relationship was going to be, which was that I'm going to end up, the paper that's going to end up being in the workshop is one where I'm going to go back and actually talk more about one particular sort of classic English school guy, C.A.W. Manning, and talk a little bit about his approach to international studies in his one book. It's fascinating. You have people who like founded the field, they wrote one book. And also talk about the deeply problematic parts of Manning's oeuvre, such as his spirited defense of South African apartheid, which I'm going to argue is, in both cases, is due to the fact that for Manning, the analysis of international politics was extremely close to the official discourse of international politics, and it was that way by design. And if you did that, then you don't leave yourself a lot of room for critique. And that is a temptation, I think, that one falls into with Manning's kind of approach. And not just Manning's approach, but also Manning's students and other people that he influenced, like the rest of the English school. So you end up with Hedley Bull and other folks sort of being, you know, trying to distance themselves from that, but still there's a certain kind of sort of epistemic temptation to reproduce the dominant terms of the discourse. That's part of that. So that's that paper. I'm not going to talk about that today. The reason I'm not going to talk about that today is because that would require me to talk a lot more about Manning, and I have not finished reading through enough Manning to actually finish this argument. But I have talked to a few people who know Manning and his work very well, including Hideki Suginami, and he said that I'm on the right track. So, okay, yay. I'm going to consider that that argument will work one day, but not today. Instead, what I want to do is I want to talk about the interpretivism part. And I want to spend time trying to excavate this notion of interpretivism, trying to extricate it from what I think is a misleading set of conceptual distinctions, the way it often gets tossed around in Anglophone international studies, social science, political science in particular, but not just political science. And I want to see if there's some other kind of sense that can be made of the notion of interpretivism. And I'm provocatively linking it to explanation in ways that I think will become clearer as I go through why I want to actually make that kind of connection. So, place to start is that when interpretivism or interpretivist gets used in a lot of these is discussions in the English language social science literature, it is traditionally and conventionally juxtaposed with something called positivism. So you end up with a positivist versus interpretivist distinction. In a way, my concern about this has to do with the fact that, you know, I've spent a long time in this book called The Conduct of Inquiry in International Relations trying to blow up the category of quote-unquote positivism and demonstrate that, in fact, nobody is a positivist anymore, and the kinds of things that we now do and call positivism are actually neo-positivism, and that's one of the things that comes out of the collapse of the logical positivist project around the 1920s, right? So that there's a history here that's gotten compressed into some weird terms. But this opposition, this positivism and interpretivism opposition, still shows up. It shows up not just in intro classes, we hear it all the time. It also shows up in major framing statements in articles that people write on both sides of this particular division. The qualitative and multi-methods research section of the American Political Science Association has a newsletter, the QMMR newsletter, Qualitative and Multi-Method Research. And the QMMR folks have been sort of debating this back and forth for a while, and so you see this distinction showing up a lot in the pages of that section of the newsletter. Small sociology of the field hint for people. Sometimes the important debates don't actually happen in the official journal. Sometimes they happen in things that look like slightly more marginal. You know, it's a section newsletter. How could it be important? No, it's actually really important. If one wants to understand the domination of rational choice theory in U.S. political science, you have to look at the section newsletter for the comparative politics organized section in the American Political Science Association. For instance, that's where some of these debates happen. QMMR plays a similar role. So it's a section newsletter, but still, right? A lot of important debates and discussions. A lot of the terms are kind of being set and tossed around through this. So if I try to make sense out of that distinction, which is difficult to do, and so I don't want to try to make sense out of that distinction philosophically, because I don't think the terms are precise enough for us to actually attach philosophy to them. Like I said, positivism has all sorts of internal divisions and so on. But I think the opposition, the way it's conventionally used, comes out in three different axes of differentiation between positivism and interpretivism conventionally. One of them is a differentiation on the ground of theory, in which you get positivist theories. Usually people will use that term when they are trying to say that their theory focuses on objective, quote-unquote, observable behavior. Versus when people say they're an interpretivist, what they often mean is that they're operating with some kind of theory of human beings as meaning-making creatures. That's kind of the scientific ontology, if you will, that they're basically starting out with. And then the next kind of opposition, or next axis of differentiation that you get is a differentiation of method, not methodology, but method, right? Where when people call themselves positivists, they're often talking about their affection for formal and quantitative techniques, and so their work reads in a particular way and proceeds according to a certain kind of logic, and, you know, uses formal symbols and, you know, crunches numbers and runs statistical equations and so on and so forth. And to crunch is the appropriate word, right? That's what happens, the crunching of the numbers. And so people who call themselves interpretivists in that kind of a distinction are the ones who are not doing that. They are not doing generally formal and quantitative style work. They are instead, to put it at the most basic blunt level, they are talking to people and they are reading texts. And those are things that often get characterized as being interpretivist research as opposed to positivist research. Again, there's a method distinction, right? So we got a theory distinction, we got a method distinction. I don't think that either of those two actually suffices for the purpose of trying to give the word interpretivism a particular meaning, a particular operational meaning that would actually make sense. Because if you think about it, if interpretivism and positivism are supposed to name styles or ways of doing research, the fact that you're reading people, reading text and talking to people, as opposed to reading people and talking to text, wouldn't tell you enough about how you should go about doing your research, because you could do all kinds of things with that. right? You could read text, you could create a coding mechanism for them, and you could perform content analysis with it. You could talk to people, and then you could put that into a public opinion survey or a focus group that augments a public opinion survey, and you could sort of run statistics on that. So I don't think method is sufficient for differentiating between these two, and I don't actually think theory is sufficient for differentiating between these two either, because you can have theories that focus on people's behavior but are still very concerned with questions of meaning, and you can have theories that are focused on people as meaning-making creatures that are ultimately about explanations of their behavior. So I don't think that this distinction really works for the, I mean, it works sort of politically within the discipline for people trying to carve out space for themselves, but I don't think it works philosophically. I don't think it works kind of operationally. The distinction I think does work is a methodological distinction, and that third thing is methodological rather than method, but that's a typo. So if that's methodology right there, that's what that's supposed to say. This is what happens when you're doing your slides in Scholars over a pint the night before your presentation. You forget things. Anyway, that's methodology. So if we wanted to give a methodological core to what is called positivism in Anglophone social science, I am not going to argue now, because I argue it at great length elsewhere, that the core of that would be what I call neopositivism. The core of what is often called positivism is a form of hypothesis testing for the sake of nonsthetic generalization. That's the basic methodological core of this thing called positivism, the thing we erroneously characterize as positivism. That is sort of not the only way to do social science, obviously, but that's one particular way of doing social science. And partially this gets really confused, especially in that QMMR newsletter debate, because people confuse the methodology and the method all the time, and so what they'll do is they'll say, we're not hypothesis testing because we have qualitative variables. It's like, well, that doesn't make any sense at all, because you can do hypothesis testing with qualitative variables, same thing as you can with quantitative variables. Method distinctions and methodology are not the same thing, right? So that's sort of confused. But if this is the methodological core of what is called positivism, the sort of hypothesis testing nomothetic generalization exercise, then the question becomes, if we want to try to give an operational meaning to interpretivism, what is the methodology, what is the methodological core of the thing that we refer to as interpretivism? So that's kind of the puzzle, conceptually, that I'm trying to sort of think my way through. So if we take a look at how people have attempted to answer this before, and there has been not an awful lot of people actually attempting to answer this. Usually they're more concerned with either the theory or the method part. Very, very few people actually try to take a stab at what the methodology of this would be, the sort of logic of inquiry would be, as opposed to the techniques that you would use or the kind of account of the human being that would be built into your theory. One of the more celebrated attempts is, of course, the notion of thick description, which comes usually out of people reading out of context two paragraphs from Geertz's introduction to his Interpretation of Cultures book in 1973. And if they're really good readers, they read the next paragraph and realize that it's a little more complicated than that, but still, right? Bad readers being King Cohen and Verba, and then good readers being non-King Cohen and Verba, right? Because you have to look at it anyway. King Cohen and Verba do like a hatchet job on Geertz. But regardless, thick description as it comes out from the sort of Geertz. And thick description is sort of an analogy, or it can be analogized to sort of grounded theory, right? So there's a whole sort of world of grounded theory that sort of fits into this too. But I want to stick with thick description because that's the term that gets a little operative play in international relations. The thick part of thick description seems to mean something like experience near, like not divorced from people's everyday experiences and discourses, but not bringing in a set of alien or foreign theoretical and conceptual terms, but sticking relatively closely to the way they understand themselves and the activities that they are involved in. So that's kind of experience near. It makes sense for someone like Geertz to be articulating this. He is, after all, an anthropologist. This is what anthropologists do, right? The typical traditional notions of anthropological fieldwork. You go, you embed yourself, you figure out what the hell is going on, you come back and you tell other people about it. That's kind of the sort of potted, not entirely accurate, but potted and received version of how anthropology works. like I said, not actually true, but that's kind of the short form. But so the thick and thick description seems to mean something like experience near as opposed to a more experience distant. I'm going to bring a set of categories to bear on a situation that have nothing to do with how the people understand themselves and sort of read things through those categories. So that would be the opposition. That, I think, is what the thick part means. I think that's actually less problematic, because what that does is that implies something sort of theoretical about how we need to work with people's own self-understandings. It's the description part that always gets me. And part of the reason that always gets me is because description occupies a weird place in our epistemic hierarchy in the social sciences. People are down on description all the time, right? Description usually shows up with the word immediately preceding it. You know what that word is. Mirror. Mirror description. So all you're doing is describing stuff. We, on the other hand, we have the holy grail of explanation. We're the ones who are going to explain stuff. I mean, this is at the root of the King, Cohen, and Verba faux diversity argument, right? We can have lots of different approaches in the field as long as y'all just basically describe stuff and give us raw data that we can do the real work with. Then everybody can play together. So I wanted to push on this notion of description a little bit. So what the hell does it mean to actually describe something? Right? What is descriptive about thick description? Well, we think we need to understand what description is a little bit more. So, for me, to try to think this through a little bit, if I'm trying to describe to you, you know, if I'm describing my glasses case here on the table, or if I'm trying to describe it to you, what am I doing when I describe it? Well, in a way, what I'm doing is I'm referring to it in such a way that it kind of brings it before us in some useful way. It doesn't actually have to be here. I can describe it to you now. I can say the black glasses case. And something comes before your eyes and your mind, you're kind of like, yeah, okay, that thing. If I've got multiple glasses cases here and I start describing it by picking it out and saying the black one, no, the one with the round edges, right? What am I doing? I'm describing, I'm calling it out, right? There's a way in which I'm sort of invoking it and making it available to us by describing. Heidegger would want to refer to this as disclosure, right? There's a way in which by describing something, we disclose the object, we bring it before us in a particular way. And it's actually much less important whether the object is physically in front of us or not. The act of description is still basically the same thing. In fact, I would argue, it matters not at all whether the object is real or imaginary. I can describe the Starship Enterprise to you. I can describe it to you in great detail. And if you're a Star Trek fan, we can even have debates about exactly how the decks on the Starship Enterprise are arranged and what its physics are and so on and so forth. And that's a perfectly normal activity, right? Fans do it all the time. It's called geeking out. It's what we do. Point being, description is this orientation toward the object qua object that brings it before us in a way that makes it available for us to do something with. Okay, so that's kind of the basic philosophical essence of what it means to describe things. This is then closely linked, you might argue, to the notion of measurement. To describe something and to measure something are, if not exactly the same activity, they're really darn close to each other, right? So if I'm trying to measure some object, if I'm trying to describe this as black, there's a way in which what I could do is you could sort of conceptualize that as, this is an exercise Wittgenstein likes to do, you can sort of conceptualize it as taking a color wheel in your mind's eye and sort of comparing it to the object. And how is that any different than measuring and figuring out that it's 6 inches long? You know, in both cases, I got a measuring stick or measuring instrument, and I'm comparing it to the object. I'm telling you what the object is in terms of the conceptual categories that are built into the measuring stick that I happen to have. And yeah, we can do this quantitatively. I can measure this by, you know, I can have a very precise definition of the vibrations that give me wavelengths of light that cause the color to be shown in a particular way, right? I could sort of measure it like that. But, you know, I could also have sort of qualitative or conceptual forms of measurement. And not just of my glasses case, right? We do it all the time when we look out the window and say, ooh, look, capitalism. I mean, what is that, right? That's kind of a measurement, right? We got an idea, like, here's the capitalist measuring stick, and we figure out, like, whether this thing is capitalist or not, or how capitalist it is. The very fact that you can have discussions about subtypes of capitalism and varieties of capitalism and degrees of capitalism demonstrates that really what we're doing is some form of measurement, right? Some form of description in this way. Object orientation, bringing the object before us according to some set of standards. Now, it's important that that set of standards, in the example I've been giving, so examples I've been giving so far, I'm making a set of presumptions about the speaker and the audience. Right? I'm presuming, in the course of talking about this description, that we share an understanding of what those terms are that we're using to measure with. and we share an understanding of how you would apply those terms. So this prior agreement among speakers and audience is what allows us to ask and answer questions like, what is that? You know, what is this? It's a glasses case. Well, okay, only if we agree on what glasses are and what a case is and what it means to refer to things. This is black. As Wittgenstein points out, the only thing this is black means is that we've all at some point learned to use the word black in such a way that it refers to whatever the hell your visual cortex is picking up from this. Doesn't matter whether one thing in my head and one thing in your head is the same. We can just, you know, as Wittgenstein says, we can divide through by the beetle in the box, and then boom, we no longer have to worry about subjective experience. It's just that this is properly referred to as black. And then we kind of go from there. This is properly referred to as a table. This is almost properly referred to as coffee. It's close. The fact that I can make a joke about that requires a certain prior set of understandings about what coffee is. Think about it. So consensus matters, right? This kind of prior social consensus is what makes possible what you might call a pure description, right? Again, speaking ideal typically and conceptually here. So a pure description, if we have consensus about the standards, we have consensus about how to apply those standards, then we can relatively easily reach agreement on certain facts, like it's capitalist out there, or it's a table in here, right? So it's the same basic process as long as we have those set of agreements. Now, imagine that we don't actually have consensus. We have consensus about the standard, but we don't have consensus about how to apply those standards. Virtually any sporting activity has this. This is why you have referees, right? In baseball, the American sport that I am most fond of, and will argue to the death is the best sport ever invented, but that's okay. There is a particular moment in the game that is very much sort of discretionary, right? If you're standing here, standing with a bat on your shoulder, and it's baseball bats up here, not cricket bats, right? So you're up here, and you've got your knees bent and such, and so there's an area that's defined by where your knees are, where your shoulders are, where the lettering on your shirt is, and where the home plate is on the ground, about 17 inches wide, and you have an area, so from about here, that's the strike zone. And it's very precisely defined in the official Major League Baseball rules. The same way the definition of a handball is defined in the rules of football, right? I mean, definitions of exactly what counts as offside, offsides is probably even the better example, right? But if you're a player, obviously you can agree on the standard, but how you apply that standard is going to completely vary whether you're on offense or defense, right? Of course I wasn't offside. I know what offside is. That's not our debate, but I wasn't there. Right? And so the batter, obviously, every pitch is outside the strike zone. And for the pitcher, every pitch is inside the strike zone. Right? So because for the pitcher, they want to get as many strikes as possible. And the batter doesn't. The batter wants the pitcher to be thrown outside the strike zone so he can get on base. So what you've got here is you've got an agreement about the standard, but not an agreement about how to apply it. So the socially negotiated solution to this is to produce a third-party measuring stick. An umpire, a referee, an official of some kind, and that person then becomes the measurer, right? They describe, they tell you what's actually happened. I think it matters not at all if that third party is a person or not. If that third party is an automated detection system, it's the same basic idea. Right? Because in both cases, what we're talking about here is like we have sort of agreed that we need somebody else to actually apply the standards, and so we're going to let them do it. Right? So that's a discretionary description. Now, what if you have a kind of description where we don't have consensus about which standards to apply in the first place? Well, now it's not a question of we all agree on the definition, we just don't agree on how to apply it. Or we want to apply it in different ways. It's we don't actually agree when we look out the window whether the descriptor we should be applying is capitalism or neoliberalism or imperialism. You know, what do we apply? How do we do that? Then you end up with a different kind of description, right? You end up with what I would like to call advocacy description, where basically what you're trying to do is you're trying not simply to describe something, but you're trying to get everybody else to buy your standards for describing that thing, right? Now, even in that context, I would argue there's still a certain kind of shared agreement. And the shared agreement, if you think about it in an academic debate, right, we all at some level agree that what we're trying to do is come up with descriptions that are more useful for certain kinds of theoretical or political agendas, right? So then we're all sort of, we've got that as a practical agreement, and then we're sort of having a debate in here about what the standards are for how we measure and how we define various things. If you don't have that consensus, then you no longer have anything that looks like a description, you just have people yelling at each other, aka current politics. But that's a whole separate set of issues. My point is, in order to have a description of any kind, there has to be at least a rudimentary level of agreement. And as Wittgenstein points out, it's not agreement in fact, it's agreement in judgment. Right? It's agreement in like how to do certain things. And if you have that level of basic agreement, then certain kinds of descriptions are possible. That shared practical context is what makes it possible to describe. All right, so why am I going through this in extreme detail besides the fact that it's fun and allows me to stand up and talk about baseball? Because if we were going to do something like a thick description, then we would be saying that the kind of research we would want to be producing would be one of these kinds of things. It would either be a description where we all agree on the standards and how to apply them, or it would be probably, discretionary would be harder unless we were playing some sort of game, you know, anthropology baseball or something. And then, or advocacy description, which I think actually we do get sometimes in these, like, what is this debates that we have about capitalism versus neoliberalism versus whatever. So there is a way that, you know, we could say that's what thick description is for. And in order to kind of think that puzzle through a little bit, I want to introduce a term from John Dewey that I like a great deal. I like John Dewey a great deal, but I like the term in particular a great deal. And the term is the term problem situation. Right? Dewey argued that all problems of knowing, which for Dewey are the same as problems of acting, that all of these kinds of problems derive from what he calls a concrete problem situation. So that the problem situation that an actor finds him or herself in and has to figure out what to do given that problem, right? That there is, for Dewey, no such thing as idle speculation. Speculation is thinking, is provoked by something. It's provoked by some sort of a problem, some kind of a situation that the actor finds him or herself in. And I would suggest that when we think about this in academic terms, then a problem situation is what gives rise to what you might call the basic questions that are associated with a particular approach. So descriptive problem situations where what our perplexity is that we don't know what something is, in academic ease, that gets turned into what is this an instance of, right? How do we characterize this? Is this an instance of imperialism, or is this an instance of neocolonialism? Is this an instance of balancing, or is this an instance of bandwagoning? Right? To use just a couple of different these conceptual distinctions we float around with in the field. If those are the questions that we're asking, okay, then maybe interpretive research or in thick description is some kind of a description. I don't actually think that's the case. I don't actually think most of the people who self-identify as interpretivists or doing interpretive research would be particularly happy with the idea that what they're doing is engaged in research that answers the question, what is this an instance of? That does not appear to be what they want to do. And particularly, they don't seem to want to do that because even though they don't like the word causal, they use all these sort of weasel words for causal, right? Things that aren't the word causal but are still basically causal. You know, generates, produces, affects, influence, constitutes, which if it's any sort of active process, basically is causal, right? It's all of these ways of not saying causal but actually meaning causal. So pulling from a different paper that I wrote recently on causation, I would suggest that if we apply the same kind of basic question and problem situation thinking to how causal reasoning works, the basic question of causality, the basic question that calls for a causal explanation is, how do we make something happen? How do we make something occur in the world, right? So there's a variety of philosophical sort of inputs to this. I'm not going to go through the whole derivation of it, but I think that basically if you look at anything that purports to be giving you a causal explanation, it's at least an implicit, if not an explicit, answer to the question, how do we make something happen? How do we bring about some outcome? Or in particular, I'm going to be more formal about it, how do we get outcome X rather than outcome Y? So if that's the generic form of a causal explanation, why do we get this rather than that? And if you think about it, if I'm offering you that as an explanation, right? How do we get X rather than Y? Then what I'm giving you is I'm augmenting your practical capacity to bring about a result. By telling you how we got X rather than Y, or why we get X rather than Y, I would argue those are actually much more similar than people sometimes think they are, that what I'm giving you is I'm giving you a recipe. An explanation of how we get X rather than Y is also a recipe for how you get X rather than Y, or how you make X rather than Y. It's just translated into the imperative form. So here's how we get growth rather than stagnation, or here's why in these cases we got growth rather than stagnation. If that's a good explanation, that's also a recipe for growth production, or I guess a recipe for stagnation production if you're interested in producing stagnation, which I suppose some people might be. But point being, the causal explanation responds to a perplexity about how we make something happen. I would argue, and have argued elsewhere, that the founding question of all of international relations was how do we make war not happen? And that's the basic initial perplexity that people are kind of grappling with. And a lot of IR theory is still implicitly a response to that question. The problem is when you get down and start talking about it not in the question form, but start talking about it in the explanation form, you move away from the original problem situation and you sort of forget, or we forget to say that like that's actually what we're grappling with. But think about most of the work quantitatively, just as a quantitative measure, most of the work that shows up in international relations journals, most of it, I would argue, is still ultimately about this question of how do we make war not happen? How do we explain why we got violence rather than nonviolence in this case, which turns into a recipe for how we don't have the violence anymore, right? So that's kind of built into the constitutive foundations of the field. Anyhow, that's a separate discussion. My point is that kind of thinking, that kind of reasoning, isn't what self-identified interpretivists want to do either. They don't like causal. They get antsy when you start talking about causation. When they use the weasel words about causal, the sort of non-causal causals, then if you push and you try to say that this is out of the logic that they're implicit, no, that's not what we're doing. We don't want to go in and modify stuff. We're not interested in bringing about outcomes. That's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to do something else. Okay, so not a descriptive methodology, not a causal methodology. What would an interpretive basic question and problem situation look like? So, now that's all the build up. Now I get to the answer part. So I think the basic question that floats around at the bottom of interpretive or self-identified interpretive research or interpretivist research is the question, how do we go on? It is the question of what Wittgenstein kind of called it, one of the basic philosophical questions, either how do we go on or I can't find my feet, I don't know what I'm doing in this situation. And there are ways that this is not a novel answer with me, obviously. This is the sort of thing that Peter Winch said a while back in the idea of social science and its relation to philosophy, except the difficulty is that when Winch said it, I don't think Winch was as clear as he could have been about the difference between that and a causal explanation. And I think that matters because if we differentiate this as being something that's decidedly not causal, it has to be practically doing something else because it's not just a description. So what is it doing? If an interpretive explanation that tells me how to go on isn't telling me how to bring about an outcome and isn't just describing things, what is it doing? I think what an interpretive explanation is doing is it is going out and looking at a problematic situation, and it is describing the applicable rules and how they would apply in the case at hand, helping me make sense out of what's going on in an otherwise inexplicable thing. But that's not just a description of the rules. I'm not just telling you what the rules are. There's something else, there's some other perplexity that by giving you that explanation, I'm responding to. What is the perplexity? Well, the perplexity in question, I think, is the perplexity that you aren't able to go on. You do not have the practical capacity to act appropriately in this situation. An interpretive explanation, the reason why I call it an explanation is because just like a causal explanation, it aims to augment a practical capacity that you have and aims to address the problem situation by augmenting or shifting that practical potential that you have, but not a potential to bring about an outcome. It is instead, in an interpretive explanation, the potential to act appropriately, the potential to go on, right? By giving you an interpretive explanation of something, I am equipping you to fit in. I am equipping you to blend. I am equipping you to do the thing that is appropriate in this particular context. Now, if we think that through, then you get, and I was really happy when I came up with this, and this isn't in the paper at all if you did read the paper, because suddenly I was able to put it into a 2x2 matrix. And I felt, oh wow, good, I got a 2x2, this is good. But it works, I think logically in terms of the sets of distinctions. I think we can differentiate between different kinds of interpretive explanations based on the relative locations of the explainer and the questioner with respect to the situation, the rule set in question, right? Interpretive explanations involve rules exactly the same way causal explanations involve general claims, right? Because causal explanations involve general claims by taking them and saying, this is generally the case, and then we're going to apply it to a specific situation, and an interpretive explanation does the same thing. These are the rules. Here's how the rules work in this particular situation, right? So that's the same sort of explanatory thing going on, I think, in both idioms. But if you think about the relative location of the person doing the explaining and the person doing the questioning and then the community of rules in question, you get an interesting breakdown of different kinds or modes or modalities of interpretive explanation. So just as and I'm putting these in quotes because I don't want to get too specifically into the sort of ambiguity of insides and outsides. There's a lot of room. These are ideal types. There's a lot of room for practical negotiation about exactly how this works. But if we have the first cut, you know, the explainer standing outside of the community in question versus the explainer self-identifying as being part of the community in question. Now, if the questioner is coming from outside, so the questioner is outside the community in question, explainer is outside the community in question, now you have this sort of translation situation, which actually is what Geertz talks about, not so much in Interpretation of Cultures, but in Local Knowledge and some of his other books. He talks about the situation of the anthropological observer as being liminal to the community, being able to explain what is going on in the community to people who are not, in fact, part of the community. So you've gone in, you've soaked, you've poked, you've done your participant observation, you then come back. You come back at least to the margin so that you can talk outside of that particular community. There's a wonderful book called Crafting Cells by an anthropologist named Doreen Kondo. And one of the things that Kondo talks about in there is the necessity to reach a saturation moment as an anthropological field worker where you have to pull yourself out. Because if you don't pull yourself out, then there's no way you can possibly write academic anything. You can't come back and give that kind of perspective. You have to have a moment of realizing, I've got to pull myself back out of this community. And she describes it in graphic terms, right? For her, she's a Japanese-American woman who can pass as Japanese, and so she's been living in Japan, trying to get a sense of how Japanese workers live their lives. And at one point, she's walking down the street, and she catches sight of a traditional Japanese woman walking next to her. And then she realizes that she's looking in the reflection in a shop window, and she's looking at herself. And she realizes that she's been there long enough that she had basically become outwardly and for all intents and purposes the traditional Japanese woman, and she was thinking that way. And she was like, whoa. And then within a few weeks, she realized she had to move domicile and then eventually get back in touch with her supervisors back at Harvard, and so then pull herself out and be able to write the kind of anthropological work that she wanted to write. So that kind of saturation moment. Translation. Now, if we have... Wow. Smash the thing. Good lawyer. Suddenly, Grit would be a much more expensive seminar if you had to pay for that placeholder television. Okay, and my no salary doesn't cover that. All right, so if we go think about a situation where the explainer is actually inside, so it's someone who's inside of a particular community, and the questioner is outside of the community, then I think an interpretive explanation functions as a form of socialization. I'm trying to explain the rules to you. I'm augmenting your capacity to actually be a part of the community that you are now being socialized into. When I get to the point in my other project that spins off or is parallel to this that talks about Manning, I think this is part of the problem with a lot of the traditional interpretivist or traditional English school type, and realists do this too in the United States, the kind of analysis that basically reproduces the terms that the participants and practitioners are themselves using. Because part of the problem with that is that now you learn that you are now socialized into that community, and being socialized into that community, there are certain rules about what you can and can't say. And the critical space is very different once you are socialized into a particular kind of state-oriented power politics discourse, for instance, than it is if you're outside of it. So I think that the nearness to the socialization imperative kind of produces this nearness to the official internal discourse, which makes it hard to find a space from which to criticize it. So it's a temptation. On the other hand, socialization can also be the thing you exactly want. Think about your introductory international relations theory courses as a mode of socialization, because what they're doing is they're giving you the vocabulary, they're augmenting your practical capacity to go on appropriately in the field of international relations. Sometimes that could be a good thing because it gets you jobs, right? So, you know, so socialization isn't always bad. All right. Now, what if we've got the questioner being a member of the community and the explainer coming from outside of the community? Well, that's what consultants do. Right? That's what they do. They show up and they tell you how to go on by not being a member of your community. They come and bring in something else. And that's often what you get at the level of higher education when you have the consultant who comes in with EduSpeak. I don't know if any of you are fluent in EduSpeak. This is the sort of thing that gets done in higher ed circles at the management level, where it's all about assessments and learning outcomes and various ways of talking about student learning that have very little to do with actual students and actual learning, but have an awful lot to do with sounding like really cool buzzwords. The net result of this process is usually the production of more forms that has to be filled out. But of course, this is also similar to some of the things that go on in the REF, right? So these sort of questions of how do you do it better, right? How do you become part of this particular community? A good form of consulting, though, would be something like when I've been an external reviewer for a department, which I've done several times. And as an external reviewer, you're an outsider. You're coming in. You got a bunch of people basically saying to you, how do we go on? How do we continue to be the kind of department that we are? What kind of department should we be? And you're coming in from the outside, and you're giving them advice. And if you do it well, the kind of advice that you're giving builds on their own understanding, but can also depart from it and move off in interesting kinds of directions. So consulting, like socialization, can be positive, can be negative. So this is not a value judgment here. In some ways, this is the most interesting category to me. And the reason why I think that's the most interesting category is because, as I mentioned at the outset, my wife is a pastor. And every Sunday, my wife, in the middle of service, has to get up on the pulpit and deliver a sermon. And the funny thing about a sermon is it's not a description of the text, and it's not a causal explanation for fairly obvious reasons. That's not what happens in churches, right? Churches do not engage in causal explanation. It's something else. So what is going on? What is that activity that she is engaged in and many, many other people are engaged in on a daily basis? Or what happens when it doesn't have to be in a church context? What happens when someone stands up and talks about the values of the organization? Whether the organization is a business, or whether it's a university, or a department, or whatever. Or, you know, what happens when you're in a club of some kind, and somebody starts referring back to the founding text, or a judge starts referring back to earlier precedents and founding documents, and so on. So what is going on there? That's not a description, right? It's not just bringing the object before you. It's not a causal explanation. I would argue it's a form of interpretive explanation, but a particular form, a kind of deliberation or discernment form, which allows us then to say, how should we go on, we all together, because I'm inside just like you are, we together are figuring out how the heck we're supposed to go on, but it is still interpretive because what we're mostly doing is we're spelling out the rules and the applicability of those rules. We are utilizing the shared base that we have, and we are crafting that into some set of instructions for how we should be proceeding in the future. Textual hermeneutics in that sense, and biblical hermeneutics and judicial interpretation are of a piece, right? They are similar. How should we go on as the kind of beings that we are, and the kind of community that we are, right? So I think that's a form of interpretive explanation. Now, what's interesting, of course, is that when we are dealing with academic publishing pressures, You can do that. You can publish translation. Consulting, probably not in peer-reviewed journals, but you can publish it. There are professional journals of, you know, what do they call it now? Scholarship of Teaching and Learning, which isn't scholarship, but that's a whole other rant. You can publish this stuff, and you can publish that stuff to the extent that the language and community into which you are socializing the implicit reader is a commonly accepted one or a commonly desired one. So as long as everybody agrees that it's important to speak this particular language, then sure, you can publish things that are basically intended to socialize people into speaking that language. This stuff, you can sort of only publish under the heading of ethics, right? You can publish it as global ethics. You can publish it as global normative reflections and so on and so forth. Which ordinarily isn't understood to be a form of interpretivism, but I think it should be by this logic. That would be a way of thinking about the interconnections between those things. Final point that I want to make is another kind of thing that sometimes gets called interpretivism that I think is not, the logic of it isn't super clearly understood, which is the sort of argument which proceeds as follows. Here is a thing in the world that we do not understand. Here are 15 to 20 pages of explication of what some theorist thought about something. The more obscure the theorist, the better. Here are some pages that conclude, talking about how that explication that I just ran through relates to the thing that I originally started out with. That mode of theorizing, that mode of scholarship, I would argue, is ultimately a form of socialization, and it is a form of socialization into the community of people who think this is an important theorist. How do I, as a member of the community of people who think Bataille or Baudrillard or Foucault or pick a French person, is an important theorist, right, Deleuze, how would I, as a member of the community of these people, talk about this thing? Well, sure, okay, that's a piece that showed me how people who are part of that community who think that person is an important theorist think about this thing. What that doesn't answer is the question, why should I care about this theorist? Of course not, because in an interpretive explanation, with the explainer already being inside of the community, the explainer doesn't have to justify the existence of the community. It's presumed. It's presumed that this is an important thing. So the operative intent here involves socialization. And if we take that seriously, then I think it actually helps us understand something else that sort of concerns me sometimes when I get more of my journal editor hat on, which is the difference in language games that are played by certain American scholars and certain European scholars, where when Americans start asking this question about so what, that often gets heard as an insistence on some sort of a causal explanation. And it's not. I think it's a question saying, why should I care about this particular theoretical community? Why should I care about this theorist? What do I get that I didn't get otherwise if I didn't use a particular set of theoretical arguments? It's not necessarily a disciplining move that says you must be engaged in causal quantitative research, but it is a move saying I don't have an ex ante commitment to the value of this theoretical language. You need to tell me why this theoretical language is helpful. So in a sense, it's still socialization, but it's an asking a much broader socialization question. In a way, it's asking the sort of question that your naive young undergraduates have when they first accidentally show up in an international politics class, and they're like, I'm a chemistry person, why the hell am I taking this class? And this happens in the US all the time, because you have general education, and people have to sort of do this. And so you have to spend your first couple of weeks basically like making the case for your field. When you are dealing with a socialization explanation directed at people who have no interest, no ex-ante interest in joining your community, you have to spend some time making the case as to why people should want to join your community. I mean, that's just a thing that I think would be helpful in terms of this. So all of those by way of illustrating what I think is the kind of intellectual productivity of dividing up interpretive explanations in this way and of thinking of them as interpretive explanations rather than thinking of them as descriptions or trying to think of them as sort of derived forms of causal explanation. I don't think they are. Interpretive explanations are not causal explanations, and they are not descriptions. They are something else. They have their own animating methodological logic, and therefore there is absolutely no reason why one should not continue to pursue them within the broad ambit of international studies scholarship, and why one should be able to resist calls to assimilate them either to description or to causal explanation, let alone to quantitative hypothesis testing, nomothetic generalization style explanation, which is not, I think, a necessary endpoint to social scientific scholarship. And I will stop with that.